This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Coronavirus has had a big impact on the Florida economy, but what about the impact on Florida's farm workers? Here to tell us more is Antonio Tovar. He's the General Coordinator for the Farm Worker Association of Florida. Antonio, welcome back to Intersection.
Hey, nice to be here, and hello to all the your audience.
So what are some of the concerns that you're hearing from the folks that you help and some of your fears as this pandemic unwinds?
Yeah, I think that's something that we have seen in the state in terms of the impact in agriculture is very uneven. One of the main crops in Florida is the greenhouse production, nurseries. All these ornamental plants, and they have been very affected by the turn down of the economy after the economy closed down, and even a little bit before. Ornamentals are not a priority for the people, so many of these operations closed very early on, probably 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, that many farm workers were laid down or let go because there was not market for these plants. Now, there is other crops that they still been harvesting. Sweet corn, Florida is the main producer of sweet corn in the United States. So that crop was ongoing because that crop is going also to the supermarkets. Right. But all the crops that are destined to restaurants, for example, they lost big time. And many workers also lost their job in those industries or in those crops. Tomatoes.
We've seen some of that footage, Antonio, of like big piles of vegetables just kind of sitting there rotting because folks are saying they don't have the people to harvest them, right? Is that sort of what you're seeing as well?
Exactly. That's one of the problems, and also what the people demand for eating, like spinach. Most of the people will eat organic spinach, but Florida does not produce organic spinach or organic. The few products are organic in Florida. They are organic production, but not in the amount that the market demands. So for the restaurants, it's basically a conventional agriculture that provide this food to this change, and they pretty much, even though they sell to go or there is delivery for this food, it is not the same amount of demand for fruits and vegetables, and those are being tossed, and workers are unemployed on those sectors or in those crops.
Yeah, so and does that mean that you now have a lot of workers who would have been here under the assumption that they had a job to do, and now they're just casting around for work? They're one of the, they're among the legions of Florida's unemployed who are now maybe trying to find help through the unemployment system, which is overtaxed, as we know.
Yeah, no, and in this, for these workers, it's a little bit. It's a little bit worse because many of them are not going to qualify for unemployment because they are seasonal. They are not going to be taxed for unemployment, or their employer is not going to contribute to unemployment, or they are undocumented as well, or even the guest workers, the H-2A workers, they do not qualify for unemployment on these cases. So I will say that even the numbers of unemployment that come on the official account, it's very below the reality that many workers face.
Do you have an idea, Antonio, do you have an idea of like the number of farm workers who are impacted in this but may not be showing up in those unemployment numbers because they don't qualify for one reason or another, just the reasons you listed?
Yes, so I did a little calculation in terms of the nurseries, because for example, just Miami has 15,000 nurseries in that county. So if we we very conservative think that there's 10 workers in each one of these nurseries. We are talking 150,000 workers that are unemployed. Now, obviously, some nurseries are very large and some other are smaller. And some of them actually are still working. Like marijuana production didn't stop in Florida, for example. Mm-hmm. Those workers are employed. But all the ornamentals are stopped. So there's no production on that crop.
Mm-hmm. So what's the immediate need then? What kind of help have you been asked to provide, and what kind of things can you do? Are you helping out with just the basics like food and shelter and so forth for people who are suddenly without work on the farm worker side of things?
So something interesting has happened in terms of food, on food production and in general access to food. Many of the growers that they lost their market, they move part of their production to food banks. So food banks are actually full, mostly in the south part of the state. And they have been moving that food to the cities and also to some rural areas. So food is right now, it's not the main pressing issue for workers, because a lot of that fruits, vegetables, they end up in the food banks. Now, obviously, this is not going to last for the long haul, and eventually they are going to need other kind of food. But the main problem for the workers is actually rents, utilities, their phone, the bills in general, because they have been unemployed. They do not qualify for unemployment, and they were not part of the stimulus package, the CARES, because even if they are in a mixed family, which means that probably the father is undocumented, the mother has documents, the children are citizens, they are not going to receive a penny of that money. Any mixed family, anybody, even if the children are U.S. citizens, they are not going to receive the stimulus package.
Right.
And that put them at disadvantage. They don't have resources to pay for rent. I should say that the most pressing issue right now for farm workers.
And what can you do to help them out, or what are you asking local authorities or even the state government or federal officials to do to help out?
We have requested at the federal level, we are requesting that all people should receive the stimulus package, that all people that pay taxes, because many of them pay taxes, even if they are doing it with the IT number, this temporary number to pay taxes, they are paying the taxes. So our request for the federal government is that they are also part of the stimulus package. At the state level, we are requesting the government to extend the freezing of evictions for 90 days, because 45 days is not going to be enough. We would like to see some assistance also for rent and for mortgages, because some farm workers also own their house, but they are not going to have enough money to pay. We have been collecting also money. We have a permanent fundraising for farm workers, and we are redistributing those funds to support some families with their rent or their utilities.
Right. It must be a tough time to be collecting money, though, right? Because everybody is feeling this economic pinch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very, very difficult time, because, you have over 22 million people that is unemployed in the official record. Now, something that we were able to negotiate with some of the foundations that they have given money to the organization for some programs to divert part of that money to support farm workers, even if it's just for operational costs, because obviously there are some regulations in which, for example, we can really use that money to buy food,
right,
at least to use that money to pay some people to deliver the food or to pay for gas and deliver the food, because that's another challenge on these times is how you might have access to the food, but then you have the issue of distributing that food. Many food banks have less volunteers right now because many of the volunteers are senior citizens, so they don't want to risk their health right now. Mm-hmm. So and also the social distance is another issue. So, for example, most of what we are doing on food support is delivering the food to their workers' houses. Mm-hmm. And leave it in their doors so they can pick it up, and that way they are safe and our staff or volunteers are safe as well.
Right. In the last minute or so we have here, Antonio, what about social distancing and safety for those farm workers who are still working? Like, do you feel like they're getting the help they need and they're able to do their job safely?
No. Unfortunately, no. There's like two different operations that are very concerning. One is the crops that are still being harvesting, which is few, I have to say. The winter season, Florida mm-hmm. is a winter season agricultural season, so it's ending. But there's still some crews that are going to the fields, and obviously the bosses, there's no social distance. They are all traveling together or they are all living together, and there's no social distance. So, and they don't have PPE, personal protective equipment. We have been giving some masks, but there's mm-hmm. not enough, and there's no gloves. And the other operation that is concerning is packing houses. Mm-hmm. There is a huge mushroom company in the north part of Orange County that they work 24 hours a day, and the workers do not have protection, and they are working in very close proximity to each other. So that's also a huge concern because they don't have personal protective equipment either.
Mm-hmm. Right. So obviously a number of things there that the Florida Farm Worker Association is working on, some concerns as the coronavirus pandemic unfolds. I've been speaking to Antonio Tovar. He is the General Coordinator for Farm Worker Association of Florida. Been speaking about the impact of the pandemic on farm workers. Thank you so much for joining us, Antonio.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And when Intersection returns, we'll talk to 90.7's health reporter Abe Abariah about what healthcare workers in Central Florida have been coping with during the pandemic, how they've been coping, and what the next few weeks looks like for hospitals in the region. And stay tuned, later in the show, a conversation with Judith Smelser. She is the creator of Orlando Wine Blog. We'll talk to her about her new podcast, which is called Unwinding. You can also find that podcast on our website, wmfe.org. Stay tuned, Intersection, we'll be back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Officials are cautiously optimistic that the peak of the pandemic for Florida may have passed. This week, leaders at Advent Health told reporters they've treated some 600 patients, and despite fears early on that hospitals may run out of personal protective equipment, they have enough. They also talked about some of the therapies they've been using to treat the sickest patients. 90.7's health reporter Abe Abariah has been following the story and was watching that virtual press conference on Wednesday. He joins me now. Hey, Abe.
How you doing, Matt?
Good, thanks. So what do we know about the biggest trends in the numbers for COVID-19 overall?
So there's a couple of things. I mean, the new cases and the overall deaths seem to be trending down over the last week or so. If you looked at the, you know, a collection of the models projecting where COVID-19 is going to go in Florida in, you know, the next month or so, about a week ago, they were predicting, there's five different models, they were predicting anywhere from 1,700 deaths to about 8,500 deaths. Now when you look at it, it's about 1,200 to 3,700 deaths between the different models. So obviously moving in a positive directions there. And the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, this is the one that the White House cites a lot. They actually are saying that it's possible that Florida passed its peak a few weeks ago at this point. So, you know, we're still seeing some big numbers, more than 28,000 cases in Florida, but maybe, you know, things are looking a little bit better.
So what did the hospital, what did Advent Health share about the demographics of those folks who had been admitted because of COVID-19?
As you mentioned, Advent Health has seen about 600 cases in its hospitals and in center cares across its system. And they say about half of those cases have been inside the hospital, and about half of those that are inside the hospital end up needing care in the ICU or in the intensive care unit. And most of the patients who end up in the ICU, they're there because they need a ventilator. So this is primarily a respiratory illness. And we're going to hear a little bit of sound here from Dr. Neil Finkler. He's the Chief Medical Officer of Acute Care Services for Advent Health.
About half the cases across the board have been patients that have ended up in the intensive care unit, which I think we would all say are the critical cases. Unlike what we had originally heard from China, where most of the deaths and most of the serious complications were in older, debilitated population, we actually started to see a much more diverse population in our intensive care units. So it wasn't just necessarily an older population with multiple other comorbid conditions that really ended up in the ICU. This is across the board. So it's a very interesting disease.
And I think what's really important to kind of point out with this was originally when we started hearing about COVID-19, the numbers we were getting out of China were talking about how this was a disease that was affecting and was mostly killing older adults. We don't seem to be seeing that. In fact, in Orange County, very recently, we've had someone who was as young as 42 who died from this. Very young, no other, you know, underlying health conditions. So what we're seeing in Florida and in the U.S. is, even though it does tend to hit that older demographic harder, we are seeing hospitalizations and deaths in a younger demographic here in Florida.
Okay, so the Florida Hospital Association has submitted a plan to bring back elective surgeries and outpatient procedures. What kind of time frame are we looking at for that?
So Florida Hospital Association, they put out this sort of as like a one-page guiding document that they gave to the governor's Reopen Florida Task Force on this. There's no timeline in there. It's not saying like, you know, we want to start on this date or when we hit this metric, you know, we're going to start doing elective procedures again. It's not that specific. They kind of get into the conditions. Like they want to see reductions in the numbers of COVID 19 cases that sustained. They need widespread available of testing, that if a hospital wants to start doing elective procedures again, that they need to have enough personal protective equipment for not only doing the elective procedures, but, you know, should we see another surge, that there is enough of a stockpile, so should COVID-19 kind of come back. They want, you know, a board that would make these decisions about what sorts of cases are prioritized. So you want to make sure that they're prioritizing cases that need to be done now, that it could cause some harm if they wait, versus ones that maybe are a bit more elective, that can hold off without causing a lot of harm, and that they're all sort of talking together. Now, what was interesting about the press conference yesterday was Dr. Neil Finkler, again, the Chief Medical Officer of Acute Care Services with Advent Health. You know, he basically said that they're targeting early May for getting elective surgeries back and also for getting some of the outpatient services. And we'll hear a little bit of sound from him here as well.
And we ask that the community continue to take all precautions as we now begin to look at how to reopen and resume safe, normal operations. This is something we take very seriously, and our president and CEO, Daryl Toll, is working closely with state and local leaders on how we can reopen our state in a way that allows for economic rebound without letting the COVID virus resurge.
It's also worth noting that Orlando Health never really stopped doing some of these elective procedures, saying that they've performed necessary surgeries, but they've delayed ones that could safely be rescheduled. It's also worth noting that there are a lot of people who are worried that people are so worried about COVID-19 that they're not going to the doctor. They're afraid to go to the hospital and their conditions are getting worse and that people could be dying from preventable deaths. It's been a bigger slowdown in other areas of hospitals than was previously projected, because we sort of expected that you would continue to see COVID-19 cases, but then certain things like, you know, people getting strokes would continue because people have no control over that. Well, we are seeing fewer of those kinds of cases, which is kind of indicative that people are not seeking help, or that there may be more to come down the road.
Right. So there's obviously some trends to comb through there. There have also been some experimental treatments for COVID-19, right? Like using the antibodies in the blood of someone who's recovered from COVID-19. You've been doing some reporting on that over the last couple of weeks. What do we know about how those patients are doing?
Advent Health was saying that they've given about convalescent plasma to about 23 patients, and they say that that puts them in the top five for the numbers of patients they've done in the country. They obviously are a large hospital system, not just in Florida and other states as well. So they said that they've had no deaths from the convalescent plasma patients, and that they're kind of being pretty strict about, you know, who ends up getting it. And so we're going to hear again from Dr. Neil Finkler. Let's listen to him talk about this.
We've had no deaths in the convalescent plasma patients to date. Again, still a little too early to say whether or not the convalescent plasma played a direct role in this, but the early signs of convalescent plasma therapy are certainly very encouraging.
And I think that's worth pointing out sort of again that at this point, the convalescent plasma is being done as an investigational new drug under the FDA. There have not been good, strong clinical studies about convalescent plasma, so we don't know that this is an effective therapy. We have seen some indications from previous SARS outbreaks that it seems like it could be a useful therapy, sort of as a bridge between getting a vaccine, which is obviously the gold standard that everyone is looking to get. So this could be a bridge to that. But, they are saying that they are seeing some encouraging results from this. They didn't really get into the numbers or anything, but they've also been doing some of the other treatments that have been sort of highly publicized, like hydroxychloroquine, and they are starting a clinical trial on that as well.
Right. And what about ECMO or ECMO? What does that mean? Explain that for our listeners, if you could.
Yeah, this is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but so this is basically a bypass system for your heart and your lungs. This is an crazy amounts of life support. So this is basically your blood is pumped out of your body. It's run through a machine that oxygenates it, and then it's put back into your body and pumped for you. So this is a procedure that's used, sort of as the very last line of life support. Typically, it's done for people who are like waiting to get a heart or a lung transplant, something to that effect. It's a very, very intense procedure. And Advent Health has done this for, six or eight of the COVID-19 patients that have actually gone on to it. And what they're saying from their results from that as well is that those patients, they haven't had any of those patients die at this point. And they've had two of them who've actually come off of it and are doing better and actually might be getting discharged from it. So that's also very promising.
Abe, one of the big questions that's been floating around has been about personal protective equipment, like N95 masks for nurses and doctors. What did the hospital have to say about its supply situation?
So basically, they said that they do have enough personal protective equipment, that they did a pretty good job of stockpiling with that early on when the crisis started. And in fact, Advent Health said that they, when the projections were more dire, actually early on started trying to order more ventilators as well. So they do have, Florida Hospital, or excuse me, Advent Health and Orlando Health both say that they have enough protective equipment. Some of the nurse unions for HCA hospitals are reporting a different scenario. They're saying that, that they're only being allowed to use N95 masks in some scenarios if they're doing something that could aerosolize patients. So they are having restrictions on when nurses can have N95 masks, even with a patient who's COVID-19 positive. So there have been some concerns raised about that, not just in South Florida, but also in Central Florida as well.
Mm-hmm. And then just in the last minute or so here, Abe, what did doctors and nurses say about the emotional toll, not just on the families of folks they're treating, but on themselves as well?
It's definitely, they talked about this being a very difficult toll, in part because, their patients aren't allowed to have family, in a room, even patients who frankly are dying, which is very difficult. And so, they did talk about how you know, it can be tough. They feel relatively well supported, that you know, they're able to kind of process it, and you know, they look for, you know, some positive things to kind of help them through when they get, you know, a note or a message from a family. Those kind of things kind of help brighten their day for this. But you know, this is an extremely difficult time emotionally for not just the families but also healthcare workers. You know, we've had these conversations before about, you know, when people are kind of in the thick of it and you're you know, in the healthcare setting and you're kind of going, you're able to kind of turn it off, and then, you know, you then have to go home and you have to socially distance. And a lot of these healthcare workers are trying to isolate themselves to protect their family because they are dealing with patients who are COVID-19 positive. So it is very difficult.
Well, Abe Abariah is 90.7's health reporter. Thanks for joining me, Abe.
Thank you.
Still to come, virtual tastings and curbside pickup, how Orlando wine bars are getting creative as they try to stay in business. We'll talk to Judith Smelser, creator of Unwinding, a podcast about three wine professionals trying to navigate the pandemic. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando's hospitality industry has been hit hard by the pandemic, with theme parks shut down and restaurants and bars reduced to takeout service only. Judith Smelser is creator of Orlando Wine Blog. She's also former news director at WMFE, and she's following the lives of some of those Central Florida wine professionals as they face the pandemic in her podcast, which is called Unwinding. Let's hear a little bit of that podcast now.
My name is Christina Peebles. I have been in the service industry for 14 years now. I had just recently started working at the new JW Marriott Bonnie Creek, which was scheduled to open on St. Paddy's Day. We were setting up for a mock service, and what a mock service is, we open the restaurant and we serve the sales department or construction workers. So it's a way for us to practice our service. So we set up the bar, and I'm talking to a manager, and he tells me, I have an emergency text that we have an all-staff meeting downstairs in 20 minutes and to shut down the bar. And at that exact second, I knew it was coming.
And the music that you're hearing, by the way, was composed for the Unwinding podcast by Orlando musician Julian Bond. Judith Smelser joins us now. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And we're also joined by Rob Chase, one of the folks who Judith is talking to in a podcast. He's the owner of Digress Wines in College Park. Rob, thanks as well for joining us.
Well, hey, guys. Thank you for having me.
Melissa McAvoy, co-owner of the Swirlery Wine Bar, thank you as well for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Judith, let me start with you. What made you want to start this podcast now?
Well, you know, the idea kind of hit me. That first week when everything was shutting down, it was the week of St. Patrick's Day, and I'm sure you probably remember there was a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion about what the regulations were, what bars and restaurants could and could not do. And I found myself writing on my blog a lot that week, just trying to, you know, keep everybody in the wine community that's my audience informed about what was going on. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm just seeing people posting on Facebook, a lot of my friends and contacts in the wine and food business here in Orlando. Their hours are getting cut. They're getting laid off. They're worried about people coming into their businesses, whether they should still let people come into their businesses, whether they can stay afloat. And I had this idea. I think I was running. That's when most of my ideas happen. And I had this idea. It just sort of came to me out of the blue. Somebody needs to be recording this stuff. Almost, you know, I think all of us sort of felt the weight of history with this, especially at the beginning. We sort of got this sense that we're really living through historic times. And I somehow just felt this responsibility. I just felt like somebody needed to record this. I somehow felt like my little sort of lifestyle blog had suddenly become the front page of the Sentinel, the front page of everything. It was all about the restaurant and bar business, essentially. And, you know, I felt like somebody needed to record that. And honestly, I mean, I tried to find every excuse not to do this. because it's hard and it's time consuming. And I knew it was going to be, and I knew it was going to be a learning curve because I've never really done anything like this. And I came up with all kinds of things. Oh, you know, I don't really have the software. I don't have the equipment. I don't know really how to do this type of thing. Someone else will do it. And I ran through in my head who else would do this. And I couldn't figure it out who else would do it. And I finally just decided I had to do it. It was one of those ideas that kind of grabbed me and wouldn't let me go, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, I reached out to a friend of mine, Amy Tardiff, who used to be a news director in Florida, public radio station down in Fort Myers. And she very kindly encouraged me, offered to do some editorial help with me. And anyway, it basically got to the point where so many people, I talked to enough people about this that I kind of had to do it. So basically I wanted, like I said, it's about history. I think I want to do it for now, but I want to do it for posterity as well.
Right. Now the first episode sort of describes, walks through, you know, the feelings that people were feeling as they realized that this thing was hitting and hitting hard. Rob, what was your kind of oh no moment when you realized this is serious, this is really going to change how we operate?
I don't think that came about really until we had to cease any sort of bar program. So this has been a retail space, you know, for the last 2.5 years that we've been here. Prior to that, it was, you know, retail shop for 20 plus years. And that's always been a great component of it. And I'm very grateful and thankful for it now. However, I spent a lot of time building up, you know, the By the Glass program and really just extending the hours and having to cut that off ended up being a bigger chunk than it would have been, say, even 3 months ago, became far more significant.
Let me ask you that question too, Melissa. When did you realize that this is kind of a really profound moment, as Judith was saying, and you know, business is just not going to be the same from here on out.
I think it dawned on me really like on St. Patrick's Day, on March 17th. I just, that day when they said like bars can't serve alcohol, and at first they said restaurants too. Mm-hmm. Like immediately I was like just kind of nervous, you know?
Yeah.
Right from that moment, I was like freaked out all of a sudden, you know?
Let's just kind of walk back a little bit because, you know, people in the know about Orlando's sort of wine industry. But Judith, maybe for folks who aren't so familiar with it, you know, how big is this business here in Central Florida?
So Rob and Melissa could speak to this too, but here's my perspective on it. Over the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years, the wine scene in Orlando has really exploded. Along with the independent restaurant scene, obviously there might have been a little lag time there, but I have really seen this explosion in independent wine establishments like Swirlery, like Digress, like the Parkview on Park Avenue, Luis's Cellar up in Sanford. None of those places existed 5 years ago. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I think that's right. And all of a sudden, we've sort of seen this great upswell of not just fine wine at places that at Disney or at the hotels or out on I Drive, but here in the core of Orlando, what we call the real Orlando, these places that are real neighborhood gems, neighborhood places, destination independent establishments that really focus on educating their consumers about wine, bringing in wines that are not your standard run-of-the-mill California cab, not that there's anything wrong with that, but training people to be a bit more, consumers to be a bit more adventurous than perhaps they would have been otherwise. I'm not saying that there wasn't a wine scene here before. I mean, obviously you have places like Tim's Wine Market that's been around for over 20 years, great legacy, many others sort of blazed a trail early on, but I think you're really starting to see a renaissance in Orlando's independent wine establishments and a crop of young sommeliers that are studying, that are coming up in the business. A lot of that, they've been mentored by George Meliotis out of Wine Bar George and some other somms around town. you know, Melissa holds a blind tasting at Swirlery on Tuesdays where kids come and study. It's there's so much cool community happening in the Orlando wine scene. And I think, you know, this thing came along just as this whole scene was blossoming. And I guess maybe that's another reason I wanted to do this, is I wanted folks to understand that, you know, number one, these folks are here. Number two, they're doing some really cool stuff. And number three, you know, you might want to consider not just getting your wine at Publix. You might want to consider, you know, patronizing a local independent business.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, thinking about things like tastings and all of the stuff, the kind of community-based stuff that goes on at the Swirlery, for example, is there a way to keep some of that going remotely? I mean, I know we're all sort of living on Zoom and these other video chat systems these days. Can you kind of keep some of that community going online?
I think you can. I kind of feel like I've been late to the game to move forward with that. Like I've maybe have been overthinking it too much, and we're going to give it a shot this Sunday with one of my peers here in the neighborhood. We're going to do a Zoom, and we've created a blind tasting six pack to go along. And we're going to see how that works out. I've been participating in one weekly Wednesday night one with some of our friends, and I've been missing a slew of other online wine tastings because I'm just trying so hard to just make sales here and to do my, you know, my diligence here for the business that I just find that I'm not available to do all of these tastings. And I'm starting to also, in a way, kind of feel like, oh my God, there's so many of them now. Like, whoa, everyone's doing a tasting. But we are definitely going to launch one. And I know the Soto District that I'm a board member of, they wanted me right away, the Main Street here, to do it and to let the Main Street help us with it. So, I mean, I was being pushed to do it early on, but like I said, we wanted to launch it the best that we could in the most professional way.
Okay, yeah. And I mean, thinking too about the other things that go on at the Swirlery, you've got, you know, it's a place where people can come and appreciate music too, right? There are DJs who play there, so
we thought about that too, like setting up the turntables and doing like a quick wine tasting. Maybe Friday night we could try, you know. I set up the turntables and then I was like, oh my God, my needles are missing. What happened to them? So I need to go get them from my friend's front porch. And then it's like, oh, we got this mixer. And so you know how it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rob, let me ask you about how you've kind of adapted, or you're adapting your business to try and move forward and keep things going over the last few weeks.
Well, I can kind of relate to what Melissa is saying too. I didn't immediately jump on anything online as far as tastings, and it does seem a little bit saturated at this point. I'm talking to you know, a publication here in town about teaming up to do something, and that might be just a little bit more light rather than like a real classroom style thing. So we're kind of tossing some ideas around and working out some details. Beyond that, really, you know, what I've discovered is that it's just a matter of staying in people's faces. I think more than ever, that social media component becomes so relevant, because if it's neglected for a day, 2 days, I mean, I feel a difference there. And so being consistent with emails and posting and just something to engage people, to remind them that, you know, we're still here as an alternative. And in addition to that, I've kind of updated what I've got in the shop. So, you know, our average ticket was probably $20-$25, you know, easily. But now I've kind of pared it back a little bit just to make sure that there's something for everybody, even if it's, you know, I'm just trying to eke out a couple bottles on their last paycheck, or, you know, with some stimulus money, just to be able to, not that we weren't offering value in the past, but just to make it a little bit easier with more options. I've also, and I just posted about it today, there's an importer that I used to sell for years and years, and now I work with pretty closely as well too, that's kicked off a restaurant relief program. So Olay Imports, they're basically, they've got a set of wines. Any of those wines, they're donating 50% of the proceeds to this specific restaurant group to benefit everybody in Florida. And they're doing it throughout every state that they're in, I believe. So that's another way that we can just offer a little bit more value, you know, stretch your dollar a little bit more. Now it's directly going to not only benefit a small business in College Park, but any number of people, you know, without a job in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything that the state or federal or even kind of county government has done that's kind of been able to help you personally, your business? And is there other things that you think local governments could be doing better to help businesses that are trying to keep their doors open?
You know, I think to echo what Melissa said too, I think it's more been the Main Street, you know, local organizations that have really helped to push the small business, make everybody aware of who's open, when, what they're doing. And that's of course huge. You know, what could local government be doing beyond that? I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. It's really, I don't know what changes when people are fearful to walk in the building. You know, I think it really comes down to who's willing to leave and who's willing to step through the door, pull up in a parking lot, and how many people I can reach.
Right. What about you, Melissa? What kind of help are you seeing, or what kind of help could you use right now?
You know, being that I am, you know, a board member of the Soto District, you know, Lynette reached out to me, my director, about, you know, what we could do, how we would push this tasting forward. So hopefully that's going to follow through. She contacted me about some signage out front, and we're still waiting for all of that to kind of come to fruition, in all honesty. So I guess, you know, the wheels are churning, but I feel like, you know, they could maybe be like turning a little bit faster, perhaps.
Judith, you know, you were talking at the start of our conversation about how you were waiting for somebody else to take on this task, this podcast, and then just kind of thinking about, you know, this project from your point of view. You've got a long background in terrestrial radio. You've got posts to hit, you know, with terrestrial radio, finite runtimes for stories and shows. But you've got some flexibility now, right? And you're also dealing with a story that in some ways no one can really see the end of. How does that feel?
It has been such a fascinating learning experience, Matt. I mean, I got to tell you, I think this whole crisis has pushed everybody outside their comfort zone. And I've stepped outside mine, and I'm so glad I have. It's been really fascinating. Like you said, right, it's not a finite time. It can be as long or as short as I want, which is really fun. It's fun to use music. It is a guilty pleasure for a journalist to edit with music. Mm-hmm. I know that's more of a thing now than it used to be, but I'm kind of old school with that when it comes to hard news. So that's been really fun. You know, it's been fascinating to follow this story with these same three people throughout time. I've just posted episode 5 today. So it's been 5 weeks. You know, we talk every week. It's just been really interesting to see the evolution of how their stories are progressing. And it's been interesting to see how the podcast has turned, it's kind of taken on a life of its own. I mean, it started out, I was thinking it was going to be very focused on the wine business, maybe the wine and food business. And it still is, obviously, and we talk about that a lot. But it's become remarkably universal. The stories that these guys are telling and the life that they're living, it's the same issues that all small business owners are facing. And adding in Christina Peebles, who's a server who's been laid off from like 4 different jobs, you know, she's been dealing with unemployment. You know, these guys, Rob and Melissa, have been dealing with the PPP and the fact that it seems like the small businesses, the smallest of the small businesses, really aren't quite on the top of the priority list for that program. But it's also strayed into territory that I wouldn't have expected. You know, these guys have been so forthcoming and genuine in talking about their families, their fears, you know, what they are genuinely going through on a daily basis. Rob's daughter just got into college, and you know, we've been talking about that and how weird it is to move a kid to a different place in the middle of this and try to pay for college. You know, Christina's mom thinks she might have COVID-19. So we've been going through that whole saga with her. It's just been really fascinating and extraordinarily humbling that these guys are willing to open up and share their stories as they have been. And, you know, the fact that I'm able to follow this wherever it goes, I mean, like I said, it's a luxury. It's been fascinating.
Rob, so, you know, there's been talk at the state, the federal, and now the county level too about how to reopen businesses. As a business owner yourself, what do you want to see? Like, what would your kind of word of advice or caution to the powers that be, what would your advice be?
It's so hard to say. I mean, of course, I want to see, I don't think that, you know, by any means we should be fully open and back to normal yet, but would I personally be open to what we had beforehand with a 50% sort of occupancy and a limited amount of people in here at a reasonable distance? Absolutely. I think there's going to be a risk associated with anything like that for some time. And, you know, it's tough because I haven't seen a lot of my kids lately because of the amount of people I come into contact with. And I feel like that'll, of course, extend that situation, which...
So you're trying to isolate from them for that reason?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my daughter has, you know, she's always had some respiratory issues and pneumonia is very well known in her life. So I don't want to unnecessarily expose them to anything that I might be in contact with. So, you know, there's a lot of chatting online and FaceTime and high fives in the air whenever I do see them, but it's a little unnerving for me in that sense. So it's a tough thing to say, it's a risk, but I don't know how much longer a lot of us can really do it without some ability to serve people. And people are so hungry to get out and to have a social experience.
Right.
And, you know, if we can facilitate that in a little bit more of a reined-in sort of sense, and we have a little bit more control over it, then I'm willing to take that chance.
Mm-hmm. Judith, some final thoughts from you. How many more episodes do you think the podcast has in it?
How long is this crisis going to last? I mean, I have no idea. As I said, I'm following this where it goes. As long as these guys are willing to keep talking to me every week, you know, I want to follow this where it goes. My dream is that the final episode is some big party, you know, where we all get to go back to the wine bar and have a big celebration. I don't know. I think that would be really fun. I also just want to say, the other voice I had to silence when I was starting this was, how am I ever going to pick just three people to follow? Because there are so many, even just in this community, so many hundreds of people going through this kind of stuff. You know, so many wine bars that I had to leave out of this, and I feel terrible about it. I think that one thing that you have to really take away from this is that these guys' stories represent so many more stories, you know, and that all of that is continuing on and on and on. You know, episode 5, it's called Groundhog Day. You know, it just keeps happening day after day after day. So in answer to your question, I have no idea. If I knew that, then, you know, I'd have $1 million.
Yeah. And to your point about the sort of universal nature of this, it does feel a little bit like Groundhog Day, right? I mean, I was reading about one TV station in Texas where they've introduced a guy who comes on and tells you what day it is because nobody knows anymore. The weeks are kind of blending into each other.
That's become a theme for sure.
Well, Judith Smeltzer is the creator of the Orlando Wine Blog, and her podcast is called Unwinding. You can find that over on WMFE.org as well as the Orlando Wine Blog site. Thank you so much, Judith.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt. It was great.
Also joined by Rob Chase. He's the owner of Digress Wines in College Park. Rob, thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Melissa McAvoy, co-owner of the Swillery Wine Bar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seely. Production assistance for this week's show from Juan Gualda. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Independent public service journalism has never been more important than it is right now. From COVID-19 to the 2020 elections, WMFE is here to help you make sense of it all. The news you trust is made possible by your support at WMFE.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.